You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Welcome to SS Britannia. Today's date is the 7th of August 2017, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. I'm joined today by the Devonshire fascist, Subal. Subal, how are you doing today?
I'm fine, thank you very much. I'm feeling quite proud, I think is the word. Proud, because the great English man, Mo Farad, true British... true British man, won another medal, and I'm just feeling like full of, you know, patriotic. Just yeah, feeling fantastic. Actually, I've got to say,
I can't believe all of this. So you've obviously caught some of this sports fervour that's been on the BBC and on the news over the last couple of days. They've been making a huge fuss out of all these Negro athletes. One of them, Usain Bolt, and I don't know why they have this fascination with him. It's not like he's even a British citizen. He's from Jamaica. And yet they all seem to be worshipping him. And he actually didn't win. He came third in this race that he had. And yet they're all still worshipping him and like bowing down to him. And it's hideous watching these BBC presenters groveling in front of these Negroes. And then they showed you footage of all these races. And it was all just Negroes running, basically. I don't understand what the fascination is with a Negro that can sprint for 100 metres. You know, they're used to sprinting to avoid wild animals or chasing after other Negroes to eat them when they're out in the wild. But it's not like a white man that runs a marathon or hurls a discus or does any of these other extreme sports. I mean, I'm fascinated by things like snowboarding and skiing and climbing, rock climbing, mountaineering. You don't see any Negroes doing any of that. You just see them running. I don't understand why they think the British public...
They sink from in the water.
Yeah, they can't swim. They can't swim.
Can't swim, can they? Because they've got heavier bones, you see.
Smaller chest.
I think I've heard somebody say somewhere that they can't even naturally... float on the water. You know, if you're in a swimming pool or whatever, and you can just kind of like float there on your back. Apparently black people just find that incredibly difficult. They just can't do it at all, probably because they're just too sinful, so they just sink down into the water.
I think it's the chest cavity. They've got a smaller chest cavity, but by the same extension, you know, they're no good at swimming, but they are good at running. But that's because they've got longer legs. You know, they've got another 3 inches on their legs than what white people have. And they've got extra testosterone, 20% more testosterone than white people have. You add that to the longer legs and the different muscles that they have. Of course they're going to run faster than white people. And if we really wanted to have equal and fair athletics, then they would have to be done by the race. It would have to be white people racing and competing against other whites and Negroes competing against other Negroes. But to put them all together, it's just unfair on the white competitors. And it's just sickening to see this groveling that the sports presenters do. And it hasn't just been these Negroes recently either. They've been promoting a lot of the women's sports, women's football. They were convinced that the English Lionesses were going to win the European Cup. And they were interviewing these women that nobody had ever heard of before, these sportswomen on the BBC, saying that they were going to win 2-0. And they were against Holland. And they lost against Holland. And I think the only reason that British women's sports teams are likely to win, because they have won quite a few recently, is because the country is so feminized, because we are one of the most feminist countries in the world. Other countries, their women don't want to be like men. They don't want to look like men. They don't want to take part in sports that men can do better than them. They want to be women and have families and have children. So I think that's why the British women's teams have been winning things, and that's why they lost against Holland, because Holland is another country that's very, very feminist. You can guarantee that the British sports team will always win against a Muslim country because the Muslim women don't want to be doing sports. It's quite simple, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, they might want to do sports, but they've got to wear that bag on their head, and so they're not really allowed to, are they? But yeah, it is interesting to watch black people competing against white people, just to return to that point. But I mean, it's worth pointing out as well that we do excel in other sports. I mean, we excel at swimming, obviously, because black people can't swim very well. And we also excel at strength sports, powerlifting, and so on and so forth. So it's not that only the black man wins. The black man's good at running. White men are good at swimming and lifting heavy things. But you're right, they do place an overemphasis on the 100 meter dash. Maybe that is because, you know, the Jews that run the media know that the black man's going to win it. I've got to be honest though, I don't really, I'm not against Usain Bolt. I mean, he's from Jamaica and he won the race. So it doesn't really.
No, he didn't.
Really,
he didn't. He came third.
Oh, well, okay, but
they've been treating him like he won it.
He won the Olympics three times in a row, so he's the world's fastest man. So, you know, I don't hate him for that. But I do get annoyed by Mo Farah, who was born in flipping Somalia, and then he comes to England. They put an English flag on him. His name's Mohammed, right? But instead of calling him Mohammed, they call him Mo. And all of a sudden, he's a national hero. And it's like, you're not British, you're not Christian, you're not white, you weren't even born in this country, and you know, you're not my hero.
They've knighted him as well. He's a knight of the realm. Sir Mohammed Farah.
Yeah. Well, according to Hollywood, King Arthur had black knights, so it kind of makes sense, doesn't it?
I think he fought against a black knight. Now, that was a green knight. Might have been the Mabinogion, where they fought against some giant black man or giant black knight. I mean, these creatures that we've invited into our lands, they pop up in all our legends and myths as the devils and the people that we're fighting against.
Yeah,
it's like the Jews, isn't it? Jews turn up in all our in Grimm's fairy tales and the myths and the fables and all these old tales that we have. Rumpelstiltskin, the trolls under the bridge. It were to do with the tolls that they used to take, because when they were all tax collectors. Yeah. And when I was a kid, and I used to draw pictures of evil creatures, they always looked like a Jew with a Jewish nose and a Jewish mouth. And this was before I was even Jew aware. I mean, the Jew does have an evil looking face, and it is the face that you imagine as a frightening face when you're a child. When you imagine these creatures that you're hearing about in the stories that you're reading, and most of them are based on fact. They were ways of warning children about these dangerous creatures. Yeah. The king's
Jews.
When
I was a kid, I used to draw swastikas all over my school books. I don't know why. I was just fascinated by the symbol. It's funny actually. You grow up and it's like, oh yeah, you can see the inclination was there from early point in your life. I don't know if the listeners believe in reincarnation, but I do. It does seem so funny. It's like sometimes you hear about people in the Hare Krishna movement. I know one example of one prominent person is a devotee, and when he was a child, he used to draw people with seekers. You know, the funny haircut that they have in the Hare Krishna. He used to draw people like that when he was a kid, you know, and then later on he became a devotee. And when I was a kid, I used to draw lots of swastikas all over the flipping place. I was obsessed. I kept thinking it's a bad symbol, but I just like drawing it for some reason.
I think it's quite natural that we would draw it. Our ancestors drew it everywhere they went. And there's a cross, and then you add the arms to it. It's quite a natural symbol for the white man to make. I mean, it can represent so many different things. I mean, it can be the movement of the stars, the movement of the plough that revolves around the North Star, I think it is. Yeah. It could be up, down, left, right, northeast, southwest, and the movement to it as well. It's a natural symbol. I mean, the cross has been a symbol that we've used for thousands of years. I mean, it became associated with Christianity through the crucifix, but it's always been an Aryan symbol before then and up till now. And I mean, you must know about the Indian use of the swastika. And it's a good luck symbol over there. It's only because of the Jews that it's been turned into a negative symbol with negative connotations now. But it works like garlic against the Jews. Garlic against a vampire.
Yeah, as far as I understand it, the swastika is it symbolizes many things, but as far as I understand it, it's primarily a symbol of the sun, I think, because the sun moves across the sky, and the swastika has that, you know, that moving energetic, like, force in it because of the direction of the lines. It's like a spinning chakra or something. It might actually be a chakra, like a Sudarshan chakra, I'm not sure. But I think primarily a symbol of the sun, which is why it's associated with the Aryan people. And yeah, there are multiple interpretations you could make for forearms. You could they could be the four castes of Varnashram Dharma. So the priestly caste, the warrior caste, the merchant caste, and then the working class. It could be the four goals of life. Which is artha, dharma, karma, and moksha. So that would be liberation, justice, wealth, and pleasure. It could be the four ages that you go through. So the golden age, the silver age, the bronze age, and the iron age. We are in the iron age right now, of course. Yeah, it could be a multiplicity of things. It probably represents all of these things at the same time. And, it's a really beautiful symbol. It also quite upsets me to see that the Jews have co-opted what they call the Star of David, because this symbol is originally it's also a Vedic symbol, and it's the heart chakra. It's the in the human body you have seven chakras. This is the central chakra or energy center, and in the Veda they would call it a yantra. But it's the symbol that represents that. I mean, not only the heart chakra, that's one of the things that it represents, but it's used for all the different gods and goddesses. They all have their own different yantras. And this six-pointed star is used over and over and over again. So it's actually an incredibly auspicious symbol. It's just, unfortunately, the Jews have co-opted it. I'd quite like to co-opt it back off them, actually. Because I think that would just annoy them, and there wouldn't really be much they could do about it. I mean, they could shut you down for, shoving the swastika in their face. But if you've got a so-called Star of David, and you're saying, yeah, well, it's a Vedic symbol, it was before you Jews ever appeared, it just kind of really annoyed them. So I think that would be a good troll, actually, if white nationalists took the Gopal Yantra, that's one of the names that they call it. If they took the six-pointed star and we started using it as a symbol, I think that would be a very amusing troll.
Well, everything the Jews have has been taken from other people. They don't have anything that they can actually call their own. Everything's been stolen from other people and reappropriated by them. But just take it back to the swastika. It seems to me to movement that's coming out from the center, and it's coming out in four different directions, but it's coming from a center and then moving outwards, and it has that feel of continuous movement to it. So it could be all those things that you listed that come in fours, that all come from the center, that all come from God. It's a symbol of the whole of creation, life that we are living. That's why things come in fours, because it fits that pattern. So I think there's that to it as well. And this six-pointed star, I mean, it's a geometric symbol, isn't it? So much of life is actually based on the six-pointed star, the actual geometry the way that things are created, and it fits in with the flower of life symbol. Have you seen the flower of life symbol? You find it in the a lot of the Egyptian stuff, and that's like like an elliptical six pointed star version of it. So this figure, this six points.
Know what you mean? Yeah.
It goes throughout life. We find these symbols everywhere, and these Jews have just stolen it and said that now it's their symbol. When the history of it goes back, you know, thousands of years before the Jews.
But yeah, I think you have this combination of male and female forces as well. The upward pyramid is the male force, pointing upwards. The downwards triangle is like a female force, kind of looks like a vagina or something. And they meet in this symbol.
I would say it's the other way around. I would say the V shape is the man with the big shoulders and the small feet. And the pyramid shape, the triangular shape, is the woman in a dress.
It's interesting you say that, actually, because I've been thinking about this recently, because seeing as we started talking about chakras, I have a little bit of a problem with my third chakra, which is called the Manipur chakra. And this is like the stomach chakra. And this chakra is ruled by, off the top of my head, this is ruled by Mars, you see. And this is the chakra that deals with digestion. It's also a very male chakra. It deals with, determination and kind of Martian things, getting stuff done. And so I've had a bit of indigestion recently, and I was looking at my horoscope, and I do have some problems with my Mars in my horoscope. And, anyway, so I was looking at the symbol, the yantra for this chakra, and it actually has a downward pointing triangle. So maybe you are right in your understanding or interpretation of that. Maybe I've been wrong for all these years. I mean, I always just thought downward facing triangle, vagina. I mean, that's in my head.
A lot of the time, these things.
Pubic hair, but I guess girls don't have pubic hair anymore, so.
I think things are counterintuitive. A lot of the time, these things are counterintuitive. Like, what you immediately think of isn't exactly what is there. I mean, people could look at, they could look at the church spire and think that was a phallic symbol, but it's not. It's more of a symbol of celibacy and the energy rising up through the church tower to the bells at the top, which are at the top of the spine, and the energy that goes up there through celibacy. Whereas other people might look at it and think, oh, well, it's a phallic symbol. And you could look at obelisks and think they're a phallic symbol if you're just looking at the obelisk itself. But if you're looking at the obelisk as a shadow with the sky around it, then the obelisk could be a female symbol because it's very much like the female parts rather than the male. It's a bit hard for me to describe it without getting extremely graphic, but you can actually look at an obelisk and think that is a female symbol, not a male one. But it's counterintuitive because the first thing you would think is, well, it's male. It's an erect obelisk. And if you look at it as that obelisk is actually, like cleaving the sky, as it were, it's more like a female symbol. I probably have to point out what I mean. I'm not being very good with words today. And words is what we were going to be talking about, isn't it, really? We're going to be talking about language and the way that language has changed.
Yeah.
Passing it over to you.
I wanted to carry on from what we were saying last week, because we were talking about Rage After Storm, this skeptic lady, which got smashed off YouTube by this incredibly dishonorable and shallow skeptic community, which has totally turned on her because, she mentioned race realism. But in that video, about 6 weeks ago now, I think that scandal broke, but in the video, she talked about Swahili and she talked about African languages and she talked about, the fact or the idea that in these African languages, the Africans themselves, they don't have words for abstract concepts. They don't have, and it just goes to further prove the fact that Africans, well, they have a lower IQ and they are, you know, less capable or incapable of thinking about higher abstract concepts. And you can see that within their language. And yeah, we were going to carry on and talk about that today, because I just, I don't know if the audience knows, but I mean, I used to teach English. I taught English in Brazil for some time. I was an illegal alien, actually, living in a slum, just outside of a slum in Rio de Janeiro, teaching English for a couple of years. That was interesting. I also taught English in Lithuania. And so I have a little bit of experience with the language. And one of the things I experienced when I was teaching English is that, first of all, I just became incredibly frustrated with teaching English, because there's no material, there's no decent grammar book which you can use if you're an English teacher. There's no decent grammar book that you can use to teach English. And this is because the Jews or the liberal elite or the communists or whatever, they have absolutely butchered our understanding of language in the 20th century. And I remember last week you made the point that you know, it's going down because we're teaching it to non-white people, and so you have to, you know, lower the standards to meet them. And that is true to a certain extent, but also there, it seems to me, there has been a deliberate and concentrated attempt to destroy our language. And it's very much, it's totally 1984. This is, you know, pointed out by George Orwell. What they want to do in the communist state is they want to create a system of language called, I think they call it Newspeak, don't they? In 1984,
yeah. Newspeak.
Right?
Newspeak. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thought crime.
And yeah, thought crime. What they do is they reduce the number of words, they reduce your vocabulary, that's one thing. But they also smash the grammar. And it's kind of embarrassing for me to talk about this because my grammar's not very good. Because, well, you know, I am what I am. It's kind of difficult to fix it in your head once you're born that way or raised that way or whatever. But if you look at the letters that people wrote home from the First World War, they had an incredibly high standard of language in comparison to the type of language that people use today. And these are the, you know, working class men, the majority of them. But they had a good, solid grasp of the English language, and they were able to think because they were able to construct these ideas in their head. And this has been destroyed. And as I say, it's a deliberate thing. One of the things that they have done is they have destroyed the 8 parts of speech. And I don't know if some of the listeners may not even know what that is. I remember when I went to school, we didn't even learn grammar at school. I mean, we didn't learn anything. We didn't learn what nouns are or verbs or adverbs. We didn't even know. And it took me years. I found a teacher and I asked them about this, and they said, oh yeah, there was a whole generation of kids where they, you know, they just took it out of the curriculum, and that was my generation. But anyway, the point being that the Greeks invented this concept that there are 8 parts of speech. This is also in Sanskrit. So you have the noun, the pronoun, the adjective, the noun, pronoun, adjective, verb, adverb, the conjunction, preposition, and then the interjection, right? These 8 types of word. And the idea is, well, the Greeks invented this and the Romans picked it up. And then when we started writing things in our own language, we basically used Latin grammar to describe our language. Because before, obviously, everything was written in Latin, and you know, English was just kind of spoken by the masses.
Well, I think we had Greek as well, didn't we? I mean, before the Romans came over and the Saxons, we were using Greek. The Druids were using Greek. They were supposed to be very fluent in Greek.
Right.
So it was Greek Greek writing a part of this as well? Did they have the eight parts to the grammar?
Yeah, the Greeks had the eight parts of speech, and then the Latin, the Romans had the eight parts of speech, and we put this into our language. So this system of having these eight types of word has been around for 2,500 years. And then during the course of the 20th century, they've just chucked this out the window. They've just thrown it out. And now you have 11 types of word. You have 12 types of word, 13 types. So they invented a whole bunch of different types of word, which didn't even exist before. They've got things like, instead of saying conjunction, they say, a joining word, something like this, you know? Or they say, that's a sentence fragment. And what this does is it just, it's so frustrating. It's very difficult to explain it in an hour, but you butcher your understanding of the language. Because before, when someone was learning English, what they would do something called parsing, and you would get a piece of well-written English, and you would go through it sentence by sentence, word by word, and you would say, this word is this, this word is this type of word. This word is this type of word. This word is this type of word. And you'd have this exact understanding of what function every word in that sentence was performing and how it connected to the other words in this sentence and how it all fitted together and created a real thing. You don't have that anymore. They've butchered it. They've utterly ripped it apart and messed it up and muddled it up. And what these Jewish intellectuals have done is, instead of having a prescriptive language where you say, this is good English, right, which follows this set of rules, and this is what the example that we should follow, what they do is they spin it around, and instead they study language as it is, language as it's spoken in the ghetto, language as it's used on the internet. And they study that, and they say, well, that's the real language, right? It's like this egalitarian version of language. And then they get slang words, and they get little different things that people say, and they're like, well, that's how people really speak. So instead of teaching people how to speak real English, we'll just teach people to speak how people really speak. And so then when you're in Brazil trying to teach people English, they give you a textbook, and you're teaching people slang and broken English. And I know Brazilian English teachers, they've been, and it's not because they're stupid, but they've been teaching English for 10, 20 years, and they get their pronouns mixed up. It's because they don't have the textbook. They don't have the foundation. They don't understand the language. They don't know the grammar. They just don't. So they hit this brick wall. They just start speaking, and they develop all these mistakes, and these mistakes are never corrected, and they just end up speaking pidgin English, Creole English.
There's no framework for them to work with. No. You have to have a framework. You have to have boundaries and rules with grammar. And when you have them, you can build new words up and think in new ways. And if you take that away from it, you can't see the way that the word is built, and you miss the connections that cause that word to come into being in the first place. So it's going to stunt language, isn't it? It's going to prevent language from evolving, and you'll just end up with localized groups that can speak to one another with other people not really understanding what they're talking about, I should imagine, as well, which is this pidgin English that we see. London English.
The French don't have this problem, I should point out, because the French in France, because they took pride in their language, and partly because it's a romantic language, our language is a bit of a bastard language. It's a bit of a mix of German and French and different elements. But
that happened with the Normans, when the Normans came. I mean, we had an Anglo-Saxon language, and the Normans banned all of that. And that's where a lot of these Latin words came in and French words. But the actual Anglo-Saxon language was a lot easier to understand, a lot easier to put words together than the actual English that we have now. Like astronomy, that would have been star lore, L-O-R-E. They used that a lot. Medicine would have been herb lore. L-O-R-E. That's just one of the ones that I can think of. But they had all these lovely sounding words that sound so much better than the Latin ones that we have now. Because if you look at the Latin ones, it's very hard to sort of pull them apart to see where that comes from. Whereas you can understand herb law, star law straight away.
Well, there's almost a psychological duality in our language, because you have certain words which are German, which are more earthy, because, or they feel more earthy to us because they would be the language, the words that were used by the peasants. And then you have this, superior kind of haughty kind of Latin type words, which were used by, the lords and the ladies in the castles. And we still have this, slightly, like a psychological difference in our minds. If people want to say intelligent stuff, they start using Latin words instead of the German words. If you want to say, like, you use a word like gut, it's like really Germanic. You just like, gets in your stomach. But the classic example which I always use is the example of the pig, right? When the peasant is looking after the pig in the field, it's a pig, right? It's a German word. But when it's on your plate, right, it's pork. It's a Latin word. Because, the lords and ladies in their castles, if you were Norman, French-speaking lords and ladies in the castles, they'd say pork, right? So, yeah, you have this division all the way through the language. And it is interesting. But the point I wanted to make is the French, they actually have an institution. I can't remember what it's called, something in French. But they have an institute which is there to correct the French language and to keep it somewhat pure. And they even go as far as inventing, French words for things like the internet or, all the new technology that gets invented. They create a French alternative for it so they don't have to use the English word. And the French are incredibly protective about their language. They can see, I think, the bastardization of English and the Americanization of English. They're quite sensitive. They can see how it is more of a messy kind of ghetto language. And so they refuse to speak it, basically. I mean, I've heard multiple stories of tourists going to France and French just refused like to speak English to them, even though they can. They're very protective because they've got more of a classical, romantic language, like Portuguese, Spanish, Italian. They're all romance languages. And they're more classical, they've got more, Latin roots. But our language, unfortunately, is being dragged down into the gutter by this method of researching the language and teaching the language. It's a combination of the two things. It creates this kind of dysgenic cycle, if you like. You have these intellectuals. And they go out and they're like, well, how do people really speak on the street? And then they do these studies. They even do like just internet searches, just to find out how people really use the language. And then they use that to create teaching materials. And then so those teaching materials end up being used in the schools, both here in England and abroad. And so then you're teaching people how to speak ghetto, right? And then they grow up and then again, the intellectuals will research how they speak, and then it just creates this cycle where you just you're basically pushing the language down and down and down and down and down, and basically we're just reducing the I don't want to say the word IQ, but I can't reducing the intelligence of the masses,
reducing the vocabulary and the ways that people can think about things, limiting the expansion of the language. The English language, one of the good things about it was that it could take in words from other languages, like French or German or Latin, but the words themselves all conformed to those eight rules that you outlined earlier, Subhas. So what's happened now that they've thrown them out of the window, when they try to add other words to the language, they don't have that, they don't conform to those rules anymore, and you end up with text speak, and you have problems with expanding on the language, because they'll say, oh well, the language is still expanding, we've still got new words coming in every year, but these words don't really make a lot of sense. You can't break them down to see where they originally came from, because words do evolve over time. The meanings of words evolve over time. A really good one to think about is the word love. I mean, they would say in the history books that a king would be in love with the person he'd just been fighting with. You know, he'd just been having a war with another country, and then they would come to a truce, and then one king would be in love with the other, because that was what love was thought of. It was being concerned about somebody else. There was no connotation of lust with it like we have today. And dishonest homosexual researchers will use that to try and say that that there were homosexuals back then because they were in love. Jonathan in the Old Testament was in love with David, things like that. It was just friendship. But because the meaning of the word has evolved over time and degenerated into meaning something to do with lust today, it's twisted our view of history. And I think this is something really quite important. When you're looking back in history, you have to think of the way that these words were used at the time and what they actually meant at the time and the customs at the time. Like when they talk about neighbor 2,000 years back, it doesn't mean your next door neighbor. It means somebody who looks like you, so part of your clan. It has a totally different meaning to what it means today. So whenever you're looking back in history, you have to look at it from that viewpoint. You have to look at the context of where it was written and what these words actually meant back then.
It's very much anti-classicalism, really, because as far as I understand it, in the medieval times, a young student, first, you would study grammar, because you can't learn anything else unless you know how the language works, right? First, you study grammar, then you study rhetoric, then you study logic, or maybe it's logic, then rhetoric. I can't remember. First, these three subjects. And then there are another four subjects that come after that. I'm not sure if I can remember. One of them would be maths. Astronomy would be another one. Another two, I can't remember. But these were the seven classical subjects that a student would learn. And right at the beginning, it's grammar. And it's exactly the same thing in India. First of all, you learn the Sanskrit, and then you learn all the other subjects after it. And the interesting thing, I mean, this is one reason why this subject really fascinates me, because the more you look at the Veda and Vedic knowledge, the more that you realize how incredibly important the grammar is, especially Sanskrit grammar. Because the whole idea in Vedic culture is that, first of all, the name of God is everything. This is the most powerful thing in the world, because the name of God is no different to God himself. That's the concept in the Veda. Because if you say God's name, then he hears you and his energy is transmitted through that name. So one of the key concepts is that you can look at the different names of God, and by using the tools of grammar, you can analyze those names and see what's within them, so to speak. Now, the example would be, for example, Govinda. Go means cow, and Vinda means somebody who looks after. So Govinda, he who looks after the cows, right? Because in Vedic culture, they protect the cows. They don't slaughter them. So that's one name of God. So you have that little... I'm not expert in Sanskrit, so I can't give you examples. But the point being that the idea is that everything, God created everything, and everything is within the names of God. But it's not only is it within the names of God in some kind of esoteric religious way, it's within the names of God in quite literally in a grammatical way. And people have written, well, one person in particular, his name's Jiva Goswami, one of the saints in India, he wrote an entire grammar of Sanskrit based on the different names of God. I think like 1,000 different names of God, and explains each name, breaks it down with all these Sanskrit rules. And the idea is that what you would do is you would meditate. So you would chant these names repeatedly, or you would chant mantras with these names within them. And if you know the grammar, then while you're meditating on the names, you know, your mind can kind of just totally just get deep, deep, deep absorption into these names and into the verses and into the Sanskrit, which explains how that mantra is put together. And you can just have like a concept within a concept within a concept within a concept, because Sanskrit grammar is incredibly complicated. So you have this, this system which facilitates an incredibly deep level of intellectual absorption and trance-like meditation, you see. So this is something which always just fascinated me about the Veda, and also frustrated me because I could never get my head around Sanskrit. I never really sat down to study it and learn it, unfortunately. But I could understand that once you know the language, these different verses, all of a sudden they come alive, because you have a meaning within a meaning within a meaning. You have different verbs, and that verb will have different roots to that verb. You have different nouns that will have different roots to that noun. And then you combine them in your head over and over, and you get like a deep meditation. So, that is not something that you can obtain with, you know, Swahili or the modern, you know, ghetto speak noises we have today.
I tell you what this reminds me of. It reminds me of in Genesis, and all the animals are brought before Adam for him to name them. So he would have named them all, and their characters would have been reflected in their names. As you were saying, these names, these words, names of God or names of attributes of God reflect the actual character behind them. And then we taught that in the beginning was the Word. The Word was God. The Word was with God. And it was from the Word that everything came about. I mean, language is really important. What separates us, one of the things that separate us from the animals, is the fact that we can communicate with each other by language. And the fact that we can write down our language means that we can pass on knowledge to the next generation, which is why we can look back through civilization and learn about how things were 2,000 years ago, 2,500 years ago. I mean, that's what school should really be about, picking the most important wayposts along the way, the most important stations along the way to get to here, the discoveries that we've made in the last 2,500 years. That's the sort of thing we should be learning about at school. Not teaching kids to be politically correct, but teaching people how to think for themselves and how these discoveries were made, so that they can make discoveries for themselves. And it's only because we can write all this down that we know all this. And that it really is what separates, one of the most important things that separate us from Negroes, who don't have a written language, who cannot pass down any information from one generation to the next. And they're no different to the beasts and the birds in that aspect. They just ape us. They pretend to be us. They will try and use long words that they don't understand the meaning of. Like Diane Abbott trying to add up. And she can't add up. So she'll just read off a script, not knowing what it is that she's said that's wrong. But it's just basic being able to add up. And Negroes can ape white people. They're very good mimics. But they can't actually be us. They can't maintain a civilization. They can't do the things that we are capable of doing. And the more that our country fills up with them, the more miscegenation there is, the less white the country becomes, the lower the IQ drops, the more violence occurs, and the stupider the nation becomes, the stupider everyone becomes, more and more ignorant, so that these low IQ creatures can still understand what's going on. So we lower the education, lower the language, lower everything down to the lowest possible level that everybody can understand. And that's what's happening. That's what we need to put a stop to.
Yeah, and of course they're also very confident at the same time. So they don't understand. they think they're really smart, but
that helps to cover it up, doesn't it? The overconfidence helps to cover it up.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it helps you survive in an African environment, but unfortunately in one of our countries it messes everything up. But returning to the language thing, another key concept in the Vedic understanding of language is that you have the five material elements. So you have earth being the grossest element, and you have earth, and then you have water, and then you have fire, and then you have air, and then you have ether. And ether is the most subtle, and earth is the most physical, if you like. So the idea is that the entire physical universe is basically made up of various different combinations of these five elements. And ether is the most subtle. And the idea is that sound passes through the ether, you see. So the idea is that sound itself is the most subtle thing that you can sense, right? Because if I remember this rightly, earth is associated with smell, water is associated with taste, fire is associated with sight, air is associated with touch, and ether is associated with sound. The idea is that the grosser elements, when the universe is created, the grosser elements emerge out of the more subtle elements. So everything essentially emerges out of sound. And the idea is that when Lord Brahma creates the universe, he basically kind of sings it into creation. And you can see this in other, you know, mythologies, a similar idea. So the more gross physical elements, they come out of the sound. So the idea is that when Lord Brahma, when he says cow, right, and he'll say the Sanskrit word go, the idea is that physical object of a cow and the sound vibration which created are one and the same. You see, it's not just a
voice brings it into existence. I mean, that's the same as in Genesis. You know, let there be light. Yes. Light comes into existence. You know, everything is spoken into existence. So the whole universe is like a continuous song that we don't hear. And the vibration of the sound is what creates the matter that we see. Because it's everything's in a state of vibration, isn't it?
That's it. Exactly. So it's a very, very subtle and beautiful point. I mean, this is why so much emphasis is also placed on hearing. You have to listen to people speak and understand what they're saying and hear the vibration of what they're saying. I had an experience when I was in Brazil, because it's not just the grammar and it's not just the words. It's the tone of the voice itself. It's one of the best ways to, understand or feel how a person is and what his personality is. This is why we love the sound of our parents' voice, right? This is why we love the sound of people from our country. And I had this experience when I was in Brazil. I'd been there for a while, and I was just walking along the metro, just got off the train, and I bumped into some English tourists, and I started talking to them. And I'm listening to this English accent, you know, and I just feel like my heart just melted. Just like, oh, my country, you know, my country, people from my country. And I had this really deep realization that it's the accent. It's deeper than anything, deeper than the Union Jack or even the physical geography of the country. It's the accent. It really strikes a nerve in, deep inside you if you're in a foreign land and you haven't heard the exact tone and the accent of your language. You haven't heard it for a long time. You suddenly hear it. You feel blissful. You feel at home all of a sudden. So it's a really, it's a really deep and profound thing. And I remember also hearing a Russian intellectual talk about this, and he was talking about the Russian language, and he was saying how, you know, the communists just butchered the language, and he said everyone just speaks like they're thugs now, you know, everyone just speaks like they're low class people. And he said that Russians, it used to be like a song when they spoke, like, it's difficult to imagine now. I don't know if there's any recordings. Maybe there are. I don't know. But he said that, you know, the Russian language used to be like this beautiful, elegant language. And now it's just become this trashy language because, you know, of communism has just wrecked it. And you can see the same thing with English today. Like, the Cockney accent's gone and it's been replaced with this Jamaican kind of drawl. I don't know. So it's, yeah, it's really awful. But the accent and the tone of a person's voice reflects their emotional state and their spiritual state and their level of consciousness. A person that's on a high level of consciousness, he will speak in a beautiful way. His voice will be pleasing to listen to. A person that's very, you know, like, oh, yeah, mate, yeah, I went out yesterday, I got drunk, yeah, oh, did you see, oh, yeah, blah, blah. You know, they talk like this and you listen to them, you're like, oh, God, you know, please just go away. I don't want to have to listen to you.
Knowing the tone of voice, I mean, that can cause all sorts of problems in comment sections because you can't hear the tone of voice that the comment was written in. You forget there's all these subtle nuances that you pick up on when you're actually listening to somebody's voice that you don't see in the comment section. That's why that's why we had these emoticons that evolved to help people to understand the tone of voice that something was made in. But all those nuances are missing. So I think that's the source of a lot of arguments that you sometimes see among people. It's just because they don't realize they misapply the emotion that was intended in the actual comment. When you're talking about people there and hearing your own voice when you're abroad, I mean, that's a really common thing. We see people around us all the time in the towns that speak our own language and we wouldn't say anything to them. But if you hear your own language abroad somewhere and you haven't heard your own language for days, then they suddenly become your best friends and you instantly want to go up and say hello. And before years back in time, because the language was just shared by the tribe and by the nation, that was how you knew that somebody was part of a different nation. It was just by their voice. This is why the Eastern Orthodox Church goes by language. I mean, it's based on ethnicity, the Eastern Orthodox Church, but it's limited by language. So if you speak a certain language, then you're a part of that certain church. And that was how the ethnicities were kept separate, was by the language. Because before we had all the immigration that we have today, it would only be your ethnicity and your tribe that spoke in that particular way. And English has become the language that everybody speaks, not through colonialism, not through imperialism or anything like that, but because it's the language of commerce. Because you have to have one language that you can trade in. That's why it used to be Latin before then, and it used to be Greek before that. But it's got nothing to do with colonialism or the British Empire. It's just to do with trade. Because that's the most commonly used language for trade. And that's why when the EU says, oh, we're going to stop using English now that Britain has pulled out of the European Union, that's complete nonsense. You know, they can't do that. It's the same as the dollar is the universal currency. English is the universal language used for trade. So we'll never stop using English. But if they keep dumbing it down in the way that they are, then it's going to seriously limit our ways to think about things, our imaginations, basically. And you look at the time when, before they wrote fiction, they had far greater imaginations than we have now, I should imagine. But today, we have dumbed down our language and we don't have so much imagination. And yet we have all this fiction, but the fiction itself dumbs people down and it's all politically correct and it's all base and encouraging people to do stupid things, whereas we have a fantastic history, religious history, Aryan religious history, which will uplift people if they learn about it. I mean, just today, Subo, I mean, we're talking today, you're talking about stuff from the Vedas and the singing the universe into creation. And it's the same thing in the book of Genesis. You know, these themes go right the way through Aryan religions. They may not be followed by Aryans today, but they originated with them. But even Buddhism originated as an Aryan religion, Vedism, Christianity, Hebrew religion, the pagan religions. They're all Aryan religions that have now become distorted as we've got further along. But they all contain elements of each other, which, you know, it implies to me who it was that created them and this element of truth that there is to them. And it's fascinating to me that the first couple of chapters of Genesis fit in with the story of Brahma. Brahma is the creator, and it is the creator that's talking in Genesis. I mean, Odin is called the creator. So, you know, there's various different words for the creator in different languages, but it all means the same thing. The creator, the one behind everything. Anyway, we're nearing the end of the podcast now, Sue, but I don't know if there's anything else that you'd like to add to that.
There's just one grammatical point which I just got in the back of my head, which I wanted to mention, and that's the difference between abstract nouns and concrete nouns. Just to illustrate just one specific example of how our grammar has changed. Now, in the old understanding of what an abstract noun is, what you would do is you would take an adjective or a noun or a verb, and from one of those three types of word, you would abstract, you would take out the essence of that word and create an abstract noun from it. Now, off the top of my head, the example would be free, okay, which is what could be an adjective, but let's say it's a verb, right? To free somebody. And then you extract the essence from that, and then you create the word freedom, right? Abstract noun. And when I learned this, I was like, oh, right, wow, that's really interesting, because we're talking about abstract thought. I mean, that's kind of what abstract thought is. It's an abstraction for built on the foundation of nouns and verbs and adjectives. So it's like, oh, that was really interesting. But if you look at the way that they teach this idea now in modern grammars, they say that an abstract noun is simply something which is non-physical. And they say you have a concrete noun. A concrete noun would be, I don't know, a chair. And an abstract noun would be, I don't know, something like an idea. That would be an abstract noun, but it's not. It's they've totally changed the grammar. An idea is a noun, like the word itself, idea. It's a noun. It's not an abstract noun. And yeah,
it's an abstract idea. I guess it's because it's in your head. It's a thought that's in your head. I guess that's the two
terms. Grammatical terms. It's a noun. It's not an abstract noun. But you know, people don't get that anymore. So it's just one example I wanted to say, just how they've butchered our language. And I'm sure there are many, many more examples, but you know, I don't want to. I also have to point out that people think that grammar is boring and they think that history is boring. And I think that we've been taught to think this in school. We've had this rammed down. I don't know if the Beano was created by Jews, but there's this, we've been taught that, history, it's so boring, grammar, it's fascinating. It's really fascinating. If you have it taught to you nicely, and if you read about it and you start to understand how your language fits together, it's like, oh, right. It's fascinating. It's like math, basically.
Well, they've made it boring, haven't they? They've deliberately made it boring so that people aren't interested in it. But, you know, I think we try and make it sound as interesting as we can here and tie it in with racial concepts and religious concepts and Aryan concepts. And, you know, what you're talking about is basically these foundations that you build upon. And what they're doing is destroying these foundations so that the future generations won't be able to build on it in the same way that we have. And when you think about it, these foundations, they all conform to everything else. These rules, these rules of grammar, I bet they fit in with the rules of geometry and the golden mean that we were talking about. All of these things, they all tie in together, and they encourage what we do when we create for it to fit in with these vibrations, fit in with the tune of the universe. So it's all in the same harmony and it's all in the same key. And by destroying these foundations, things will be created that are out of key, that are harmful to us, which is what we see all around us. Our science is harmful to us. Everything we're doing is harmful to us because it's all out of key with creation. It's all going against creation. It's all about death instead of being about life. It's about breaking natural law instead of building in accordance with it. I think next week I didn't have time this week. Next week I'll look out some of these Anglo-Saxon words because I've got a book on it, which I think the listeners might like, and I think you'll find it interesting as well, Subal. So I'll just remind people that we do have a Bitcoin wallet at the radioarian.com site. Also, Morgoth could do with donations over at Morgoth's Review. Thank you very much for coming on, Subal. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next week with more SS Britannia for you. So until then, we hope you all have a wonderful week ahead of you.
Listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.